Day 150, Saturday, February 1st. So I'm in New York City, Super Bowl weekend. And I headed up to my parents' house in Rockland County, about 45 minutes north of the city. Mostly because my brother Pat was driving up from South Jersey to meet me there. He was bringing my nephew Danny, whose vocabulary was increasing daily. And I wanted to hang out with the favorite boy on earth. So I took the bus from New York City up near my parents' house. What was my event going to be on that Saturday? Well, fortunately, the Rockland County Wrestling Championships were being held today. My dad picked me up at the bus stop. So this is like full circle. A couple weeks ago, he had picked me up, dropped me off at a high school basketball game. This time he picked me up at a literal bus stop and took me over to Tappan Zee High School. I asked him if he remembered the last time he'd been in a gymnasium. And he did some memory searching, and he realized it'd been 20 years ago to watch my brother Pat wrestle in his freshman year of high school. So that seemed like a fitting number, 20 years. In the gym, I ran into a friend of mine from high school, Jimmy Kelly, whose son James was the top seed at 99 pounds. Jimmy hadn't wrestled in high school. He played soccer, and he scored beers from a deli that served underage kids. Naturally, he became NYPD and retired from the force. I got to see his son pin his semifinals opponent in less than a minute. But I didn't watch much of the match. I actually watched Jimmy watching James. And at that point, I realized that one of my favorite parts of sports year had been getting to witness my friends cheering on their kids, you know, and seeing that paternal potpourri of nervousness and enthusiasm, right? Like dread and encouragement, satisfaction and resignation. But the thing that resonated with me the most was parents' helplessness. Moms and dads, they can only look on powerless, right? They want to help their kids. They're out there on the mat or on the court, on the field, and they can't do anything. They just sit there and they're like, ah, helpless. I'd never noticed that before I'd started sports here. And now I always look for it. I ended up experiencing my own feeling of helplessness only a couple minutes later on as my dad and I were trying to leave the gym. So the doors out of this gymnasium were between two big sets of bleachers, and the bleachers were packed with people, obviously, and but there was a huge set of doors, and I thought it was impossible to miss them, but my father walked right past them. So I thought that was kind of funny, and you know, I called out to him, and he couldn't hear me over all the screaming of parents and teammates, you know, for the wrestling matches that were happening. So I'm watching in panic as my dad keeps walking like into a corner of the gym. There are no doors there. He's just walking into a corner. And he searched around a little bit, and then finally it clicks. He turns around. He's like shaking his head at himself, and he looks up at me, and we make eye contact. He, you know, kind of grins sheepishly, but I was standing there panicking. And why was I panicked? Well, in a long line of diseases that the Reedys have passed on, mental illness is one of them, especially on my dad's side of the family, along with, in no particular order, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, alcoholism, pancreatic cancer, colon cancer, male pattern baldness, you know, just genetic lottery over here with the Reedys. So I'm hypersensitive to any signs of dementia, especially in my dad. And so him walking right past two huge open doors seemed like it might be symptomatic of something, you know? And I'm probably a harsher critic. You know, you hate to watch your parents get older, and I'm sure it was disorienting. He hadn't been in the gym in forever, and it was really loud. But I was losing it, you know? It was a gym he'd never been in before, but I overreacted. Seeing him struggle, you know, it really hit me. And then in the car, I was nervous, and I just started burning off nervous energy. And I'm all, hey, Dad, speaking of the high school wrestling we just saw, how about my high school wrestling career? You know, I just started like rambling. And I asked him if he remembered a big match that I won in my senior year. One of my goals was to go to the regions. And to do that, I had to place third in the districts, a minimum of third. And so in the semis, if I win, I'm in the finals, I'm going to regions, right? And that was one of my goals that I'd written down, you know, posted on my bulletin board in my bedroom. And I asked him, you know, do you remember that, that win? And instantly, Rich Reedy beamed at the memory, you know? He goes, yeah, I was sitting in the front row, and after you won, I stood up and I yelled, yeah, yeah! And I couldn't believe it. Yeah, that is exactly what happened. It was Saturday morning in late February 1988, and it was a sleepy gym, and the sun was, you know, shining through the windows, and it wasn't packed like the gym we had just been in, right? And so he's right close to my match. He stands up, and he screams just like that. Yeah, yeah! You know, and I mean, it embarrassed. It echoed so much around that gym, and I was so embarrassed. But then I looked up and I saw him and how proud he was. And I forgot that I was embarrassed, you know. That made me so proud that I made him proud. And then I'm sitting in my dad's car, you know, a million years later, and I felt pride like that again. I said, Dad, you yelled so damn loud. And he looked at me with this smile. He's like, you know, the smile just said, of course I did, you know. And same guy. Within 10 minutes, I'm ready to, you know, get him to a neurologist. And then he remembers, you know, this crazy big moment for me, you know, years later. And it reminded me, I was lucky that I get to observe my parents getting older. You know, a lot of people don't get that. I had that luxury. It was a nice way to wrap up that day.
This is Sports Year. I'm your host, Jamie Reedy, the lunatic who attempted to attend 365 sporting events in 365 days. Join me as I revisit my time on the road when I traveled across this great country in my beat-up old Saab, going to everything from the Super Bowl between the Seahawks and the Broncos to an adult league inner tube water polo match in the Deep South. But this adventure was more than just my getting to go and see a Cowboys game in Jerry's World or women's collegiate volleyball in Nebraska. It was about connecting with old friends and making new ones. It was about my efforts to bring wounded veterans to games on their bucket list. And it was about depending on the kindness of strangers and learning lessons along the way. Episode 17, Game Over.
Day 151. 151, Sunday, February 2nd. Super Bowl Sunday, baby. When I had initially started planning Sports Year, I assumed that my Super Bowl ticket would be, you know, the most difficult and the most expensive to acquire. And I ended up wrong on both counts, thanks to the fact that I invited myself to the game. So leading up to the NFC Championship between the Niners and the Seahawks, my buddies at the beach, we got a big kick out of the fact that two of the guys, one was a diehard Niners fan and one was a diehard Seahawks fan. And so it was fun just to watch them, you know, hey, you guys want to get together and watch the game? Like, no way. They couldn't even, you know, in their 40s, they could not get to a bar and watch together. Such was their animus. And so on the Monday before the NFC Championship, we met out for drinks in Hermosa Beach. And our friend Alan, who works for the NFL Network, starts telling a story. Just as he's telling the story, I tap out and head to the bathroom. I come back. I see Jim is just like glowing. I'd never seen him so happy. And Alan had this look on his face like, who's a better friend than me? And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. It turns out that Alan, in his role as an executive at the NFL Network, gets two free tickets to the Super Bowl. And he announced to the group while I was in the bathroom that if the Niners win, he's giving them the tickets to our friend Dave. And if the Seahawks win, he's giving them to our friend Jim. So Jim felt pretty good about the Seahawks' chances, so he's thinking he's going to the Super Bowl. So we all knew that if San Francisco won, Dave was taking his dad. Like, that was totally the thing. But Jim, who's Jim going to bring, right? Like, it. Nobody knows who Jim's going to bring. I instantly say, awesome! Jimmy, you're going to give me your extra ticket, right? Sweet. I mean, what type of person does that? I mean, who raised me? My parents should be really embarrassed. Where does this sense of entitlement come from? Like, just because I know that Jim's not going to bring his dad, maybe he's from the Pacific Northwest. That's why he's a Seahawk fan. He might have a friend from high school or college that he would bring. But no, Jamie Reedy, entitled jackass. I just blurted out, like, you're bringing me. But I really thought that he was going to bring me. You know, it wasn't like, ha, 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 you're going to bring me. No, I thought, like, done deal. Sweet, I got a ticket. So Jim is one of the nicest people on the planet. And, you know, if Jim had said that to me or anybody, if I'm like, oh, I would have read the Riot Act, you know, probably would have tweeted something really funny about it. Instead, Jim just says, yeah, okay, Reedy, I'll bring you. What a nice guy, right? So sweet. Now I am going to the Super Bowl. Got that. Check that block, right? So 2 weeks later, we're both in New York City, Super Bowl Sunday. And unfortunately, both of us were questionable for the game. We're on the injury report. As Al Michaels would have said, we both had stomachs. So Jim had caught a flu, and it was so debilitating that he nearly didn't get on his... So he was taking the red eye Friday night, landing at JFK Saturday morning. He nearly didn't get on the plane in LA Friday night because his flu was so bad. So he lands at JFK, and then he just stays in bed for 24 straight hours. That's a serious illness. Now, my tummy, less of an innocent history, more directly traced to my lunatic evil cousin, Brian, who I've mentioned about the Army-Navy game, the guy who sneaks bourbon into games in the double Ziploc bag. Brian kept me out very late on Saturday night. I slept till 11 a.m., which would have made me late to meet Jim, except that Jim didn't want to get to the game early because he was on his deathbed. And we couldn't have gotten there 6 hours early anyway to party because of terrorisms. Or I should say because of terrorists. Terrorisms is not a thing. So this was the first New York Super Bowl, even though it's being played in New Jersey. So the security concerns were off the charts. Everybody from the federal government down to the state government was afraid that bad guys were going to try to do something really big. So they banned tailgating in the parking lots. That's not very cool. And then they really limited the number of people who could even show up in like limos or special buses. Right? They were really trying to get everybody to take mass transit, meaning New Jersey Transit, the trains or buses. So Jim and I meet up at Penn Station, which is beneath Madison Square Garden, and we're going to catch the train. If you ask a stranger who looks worse, me or Jim Mattler, they wouldn't have been able to tell because Jim was green from the flu and I was green from the cocktail flu. So everybody in the train station, seemingly, was wearing blue and orange for the Broncos or green, blue, and gray for the Seahawks. It was pretty awesome. Standing in line for tickets, I spoke to a guy who was wearing a vintage Seahawks number 10 jersey that was made famous in the 70s and 80s by their lefty quarterback, Jim Zorn. This guy in Penn Station said that last night he happened to be walking down the streets of New York and saw Jim Zorn. So that's like, right? That is something big. And Jim Zorn signed the back of the jersey. I'm like, come on. The guy turns around and there it is. Jim Zorn signed the back of the jersey. Right then, maybe I should have thought about betting on the Seahawks. So we get our tickets. We head down to the track. Then they had, but they had security even in New York City. So we still have to go across the river to Jersey, but they had security checking to make sure we had a legit Super Bowl ticket, which we both did, thanks to Alan. So then we're trying to transfer inside the station in New Jersey, in Secaucus, and there's this huge logjam. So New Jersey Transit, in their infinite wisdom, had everybody stick their train ticket through this teeny slot in the turnstile. So this probably isn't a big deal on normal commute days. Everybody's a veteran commuter. Bing, bang, boom, they know how to do it. Well, Super Bowl Sunday, everybody's from out of town. Also, everybody had maybe started pre-gaming. And it's the whole stand there, oh, wait, is it this pocket? Is that pocket? So nobody could just make it one and done, right? We couldn't even get through the turnstiles to get in to change trains. We finally get through, and we stand in line for 45 minutes. 45 sweaty minutes. So the biggest fear of the Super Bowl planners, is this a great idea to have a Super Bowl in New York in February? Probably not, but we're going to do it anyway. So the biggest fear was terrorism. The second biggest fear was weather. It's February in New York. So they were afraid there was going to be a blizzard, just like the kind that had been predicted in the 2014 Farmer's Almanac. So the snowstorm would have sucked on three levels. So it's fans would get to the game late, fans freeze their asses off at the game, and fans at home turn off the TV because it's a sloppy, crappy game, right? So all three, the NFL loses because it's an outdoor stadium. They're having a football game. The premier football event is being held outdoors in the Northeast. It's not a great idea. So the NFL was very happy when they woke up on Super Bowl Sunday, and it was 50 degrees. It's kind of sunny. Hey, no blizzard. This is awesome. Except all of us from out of town were dressed like the little kid in A Christmas Story, you know, where he can't put his arms down from all the winter clothes. So we are standing inside the station with our ponchos, ski pants, all this type of stuff. Hundreds of us inside Secaucus Junction, and we would have loved it to be 50 degrees. So because everyone was planning for a blizzard, the New Jersey Transit station manager set the thermometer to keep it warm because it was going to be cold. Only it wasn't. It was hot, and everybody was dressed for the cold. So it got worse. People started fainting. Legitimately fainted, and then they had to like try to jam medical personnel through the crowd. There's nowhere to go. I look at Jim. I already have a walking wounded with me. Jim Mettler is nearly dead, and he's got black hair. It's all glistening with sweat. He's looking even fluier than he had been. People start just like undressing, and my favorite was one total Jersey Guido strips down to a white tank top. It was so fantastic. So the fans were standing there. We got nothing to do. And they start chanting, right? And so the Seahawks have a standard chant. One person just yells out, "See!" And everybody else in the vicinity yells out, "Hawks!" It seems like a pretty simple cheer, but it's really freaking loud. Holy cow, do they get behind it. And then Bronco fans would go right from third grade with, "Here we go, Broncos, here we go." I mean, come on, people. It was so lame. And right there, again, my second clue, bet on the Seahawks. They are better. Nobody had beers with them because, hey, that's not going to take an hour to get from New York City to the game. So people couldn't keep cocktailing, right? That's not good. Now people are losing their buzz. One guy had a Bud Light Tall Boy can that he popped open, and people were looking at him like it was the elixir, you know, that would give us eternal life. And I asked him, "Hey, man, how much would you take for that beer?" And he didn't even like hesitate. He's obviously been thinking about this. He goes, $250. Okay, I'm not going to give you that money, sir. But good on you to have an answer. Finally, in all of this, a New Jersey Transit person makes the command decision to not require tickets to be put through the turnstile anymore. I mean, everybody's going to the same place, right? Nobody's hustling New Jersey. Whoosh! We all rush through. We get off at the station at MetLife Stadium. We're going to have a great time! No, more security. They have this ginormous tent, like an airplane hangar, set up with a snake line of gates to get us through like TSA clearance, basically. That is what we still had to go through. Finally, after like another hour, we get through there. And Jim and I head right for the beverage stand, as two true red-blooded Americans should do. And we buy bottles of water because we are totally sick wusses. I did get a $16 Super Bowl draft beer. We were sitting in the upper deck, directly behind the Seahawks end zone. Did you know that Super Bowl attendees get a swag bag? Like everybody does, even us up in the upper deck. Pretty cool. Earmuffs, Kleenex, and other stuff we didn't need. But if it had been cold, we would have needed all that stuff. And the gift lift, the gift bag, that's like a seat cushion right there. So we were loving it. We sat down next to a Bronco fan. He had a shaved head with a Bronco tattoo. Like, the Bronco team logo was tattooed on this guy's scalp. And it was pretty cool that that was the most team spirit I had seen in all of sports here. So it was perfect that I saw it on that day. MetLife Stadium holds 82,500 people. The NFL gives out 17.5% of those tickets to each team. All right, so you do some math. That means each team got 14,000, roughly 14,000 tickets. I don't know how the Seahawks fans managed it, but it was louder. They only had half the stadium, and it was louder than the 80,000 LSU fans had been at Death Valley. So if you recall, back in September, I said that Death Valley at LSU was the loudest stadium I'd ever been to. I had to change that because... I shouldn't say I had to change that. They were still louder, but far less Seahawks fans made almost as much noise. And if you recall the Broncos-Seahawks Super Bowl, it wasn't much of a game. First play of the game, the Denver center snaps it over Peyton Manning's head, out of the end zone, safety, and the romp was on. Jim jumped higher than any flu-stricken person has ever jumped, I'll say, in history. But he shouldn't have been jumping. I was worried for him. I wanted him to sit down. I wanted him to stay bundled up. And that was fantastic. Like, it was just all the Seahawks fans were doing basically was dancing from that point on. And I'm not just talking about Bruno Mars' sensational halftime show. It was so cool to see how happy Jim was. And my friends who are Broncos fans, they're in Denver. They weren't right there with me. They didn't give me a Super Bowl ticket like Jim did, so I was rooting for them. So the game ends. He can't even... I'm dying to buy him a celebratory beer, but he can't have it because he won't be able to stomach it, right? And we're just getting ready to leave. I mean, the Seahawks rolled 43-8. And Jim turns to me and says, you know, this reminds me of the preseason game when we beat them 40-10. Jim, how about you share that information with me? Maybe I would have called our athletic investment counselor. So I didn't wager in the game, but Jim had wagered in the game. So not only did his team win, he won. So post-game, we think we're floating out of there. We're just going to get right back on that train and head to New York City. No. The public address announcer says, do not leave the stadium. I mean, this is not what you want to hear. Where everybody was worried about terrorism going into the day, and now we're told by like this the voice of God, do not leave the stadium. So it turns out that when you suggest to 60,000 people that they all take mass transit to the game, those people want to take it home too. And the station got overwhelmed. And so they just stopped letting people get into the stadium, like stop using the trains. So we ended up hanging out inside MetLife Stadium for another hour and a half, 2 hours, waiting to get out of there, you know? And again... not serving beer. There'd have been one thing if they, hey, crank up those concession stands and sell us some beer. No, that was it. We just hung out. Like, very frustrating. I'm still frustrated because that would have been fun to drink a couple of victory beers since I was a new Seahawks fan. My third favorite moment of the day occurred while we were finally exiting. And it's that third favorite moment behind Jim being so happy and then Bruno Mars's amazing set. We're walking out. And I see a guy wearing a vintage number 55 Seattle Seahawks jersey. This is Brian Bosworth. The Boz, all right? So if you are unfamiliar with the history of the Boz, he had a poor walk-to-talk ratio in his short time in the NFL. He'd been a superstar in college. They got to the NFL, and he just didn't deliver in his first-round draft pick. Very yappy self. So here this guy is wearing a Boz jersey to the Super Bowl. And I had to ask him, I'm like, the Boz was a low point in Seahawks in Seahawks history. Why would you wear that jersey? And this guy looks right at me and goes, you got to remember the bad times to appreciate the good, man. And I'm like, yes, thank you, football philosopher. Seahawks! So I suggest that everybody go to the Super Bowl once. I mean, it's the iconic American sporting event, right? And it was exhilarating, and it is exhausting. It is a long day. It's a long day. I recommend everybody goes once, but unless your team is playing, do not spend your own money. Like, it's just not worth, a ticket that's like a grand, and then beers that are $16 and hot dogs that are $12, 3 hours after the final whistle, Jimmy and I got on our final train. We got to the city at 1:30, and he said, Reedy, I'm ready for a victory drink. I immediately texted Alan, our ticket donor, and we met up. 2 a.m, we're at a Midtown saloon, and they raised a glass, and they said, here's to you, Reedy. Here's your sports year. 151 days. It was a hell of a run. And I clinked glasses with them, and I smiled, and I made eye contact like you're supposed to. I drank to the toast. But I could not wonder, sports year's done. Was it really a great run? Day 175, or what should have been day 175, Wednesday, February 26th, Manhattan Beach, California. It was hard to believe that 3 weeks had passed since I attended the last event of sports year, the Super Bowl. I never signed off. I didn't let my Facebook page followers know that I was officially done. I was just dragging my feet. I was embarrassed, Now I'm sitting here on this Wednesday and I'm kicking myself. Like, how is it possible that I haven't explained that I shut down sports year on day 151? I wrote a couple of drafts of like a goodbye letter and I didn't do anything with them. And basically I was just, struggling with embarrassment, right? I mean, I didn't even get halfway through the year. 6 months might have been okay, right? I could live with that. But 151 days, I mean, I don't even drink rum. So that number just sounds lame, 151. But you know what's lamer than quitting on day 151? It's lamer to live with crushing debt. And it just got too much. Yeah. It's funny. I've got unshakable faith in myself. Maybe I should say I used to have unshakable faith in myself, but I got rattled by my failure to complete this journey. When I began sports year, I was certain, absolutely certain, that a corporate sponsor was going to swoop down and support me. I didn't need big money, just enough to keep me going. But I failed to crack the social media code and directly because of that didn't get interest with sponsors. And if anybody's wondering, a really good way to incur debt is to start a year-long journey in debt. That is a surefire, I promise you that. That's why I had to shut down sports year and get a job. And both parts of that sentence, man, they hit me hard. But I learned that, there are fates worse in life than working. You might remember on day 2 of the trip in Lincoln, Nebraska, I met the national sales manager for a medical device company, and he had offered me a gig. And I followed back up with him in November in Lincoln. And part of me felt like a loser, slinking back into the sales world. But a big part of me was psyched that somebody was willing to give me another shot. I mean, after all, I wrote a book that should have led to a lifetime ban from the medical industry. So I put on my sales hat again. I joked that it was a little loose because I'd lost a lot of hair since 2005. But it felt good. And it made me feel better, with a little distance to kind of look back on what I experienced in sports year. Sure, it was only 151 days, but I experienced some really cool things. on Christmas Eve, I pulled into a bowling alley parking lot caring only about keeping some arbitrary streak alive. And 45 minutes later, I left with a better understanding of determination. That's what happens when you meet a pair of teenage brothers who bowl in their wheelchairs. Nick and Matt, the Leo brothers, despite their degenerative muscle disease, those guys competed for their high school team, right? That was a great early Christmas present for me. I got to see the Wounded Warrior amputee softball team. They're running around playing softball like they don't have any problems at all. Go see them if you get a chance. You're going to leave marveling at the resiliency of the human spirit. And you're going to feel really appreciative for how good you've got it. During my 151 days, I discovered women's sports. Like, I discovered them. They didn't exist beforehand. I know that sounds really stupid, but to me, it felt like I discovered them because I was so clueless to how fun they are and how competitive and how athletic. I made one of my only goals, and I succeeded at. I made my goal of attending 45% female events. Woohoo! If not for Sports Year, I would have stayed oblivious to how awesome women's sports are. And I have a new favorite sport, women's indoor volleyball. I took 5 wounded veterans to games on their sports bucket list. And statistically, that was pretty big fail, since I was hoping I would, average 1 a week. I barely got 1 a month. But on the plus side, I made new friends. And I helped, I helped some men forget their troubles for a couple hours. Specifically, one soldier and his grandpa, lifelong Packer fans, attended their first game at Lambeau. In another case, down at LSU, Aaron, the ex-soldier, was honored by LSU baseball at a home game on Sunday, February 23rd, 2014. They called him out and thanked him for his service. I wish I could have been there. On a far less tangible level, I learned that my story inspired some people. Very few adults can drop everything and try something as crazy / foolish / stupid as attending a different sporting event every day for a year. And even people who question my sanity and intelligence, told me that they were a little envious, right? And they said, man, I wish I could break away, do something different. So I guess the worst case, I had a blast watching sports every day for 151 days. I made new friends. I reconnected with old ones. I watched my buddies watch their kids play. And that, that was mind-bending and way more fun than I anticipated. In the best case, I learned some important things about myself. Things I probably should have figured out a long time ago, but I'm a slow learner. I write about them in my book that's based on Sports Year. It's called Need One. It's available on Amazon. And I ended up just really thankful for the people who supported me monetarily with my mismanaged crowdsourcing, and people who gave me a place to stay, people who fed me, people who found me events. I'm forever indebted to them. I'm appreciative that people, strangers, followed me on Facebook and Twitter. I hope I gave everybody something to cheer about. Need One came out 3 years after Sports Year ended, which was also embarrassing because it took me that long to write it. But I was really happy with it, if I do say so myself. And I wanted to say thank you to some people. I had told Nick and Matt Leo that if they let me talk to them, that they'd be a chapter in the book. And I had to prove to them that I, honored that commitment. So I found their high school bowling coach online. Turned out he was a Notre Dame grad, so that was a fun surprise. And I mailed him, 2 signed copies of the book, 1 for Matt, 1 for Nick. And I thought that was the end of it. And then a couple of months later, I got a thank you card in the mail. And I just want to read a little bit of it. because sometimes when I still kick myself because I only made 151 days, you know, what a loser. I pull this card out and I read it and it tells me that maybe I wasn't as much of a loser. Hi, Jamie. What a great surprise this was for the boys and us. When they talked about meeting you that Christmas Eve, who knew you would really do it? Good for you. Nicholas and Matthew, of course, showed it all around school. Even the principal. It even made it into the newsletter. Thanks for bringing such fun and joy to them and us. Not everyone can say they were in a book. Thanks again for the kind words, Annette and Steve Leo. No, thank you, Mrs. Leo. That's my favorite thank you note of all time. And just that alone makes me feel great that I try to do sports here. This has been a Soundstage Productions original series. I'm your host, Jamie Reedy. Based on the book Need One by me, Jamie Reedy. Produced and engineered by Brian Dick. Executive produced by Phil Guidry, Ross Necessary, and Brian Dick. The music you heard was written by Trey Comstock. And the Sports Year logo was created by Angela Lewis.